welcome to a special edition of Mentioned in Dispatches. In keeping with our theme for this season, we've got more rookies on the on the podcast, or at least new to Mentioned in Dispatches. But we've got two very special guests tonight. The first one is a guy that I've known for over a decade now through Origins and the Wargaming circles. Have interviewed him on a previous podcast related to the Honorverse at HonorCon, and that is Mr. Chris Weave. Chris, how are you tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Doing great. Doing great. And as always, the caveat of we say, how are you doing tonight? Like, we're recording this in the evening. I don't know when people are going to listen to this. It could be 4 a.m. and you know, how are you doing today, I guess, is where we're going with that. The man of the hour, the reason we have all assembled on tonight's podcast, is a now world-renowned author and, you know, Afro guy and all-around wargaming man of many traits, Matt Caffrey, the author of the On Wargaming book. Hello, Mr. Matt. How are you?
Very fine. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm looking forward to this.
Oh, love it. And so I met Matt and Chris about the same time, which was 12, 13 years ago at Origins through my involvement with the Origins War College. Somewhere in there, Matt realized there was a wargamer floating around that he had not yet spoken to about coming to talk at the War College. I think I was like the only one in the building that hadn't been approached by him yet, and he rectified that in a hurry. And got me to come give some talks at the War College. And then, you know, that grew into a whole lot of other involvement there. And along the way, I met Chris, where I got roped into moderating a couple of panels at Origins. And by moderating, really what we mean is I introduced the panel, I threw out a question, I completely lost control of the panel. Is really sort of how it worked. And so, Chris, briefly, to the extent that you're able, without like breaking any sort of classification rules or anything, I know you're in the professional wargaming space. Where are you now, and what is it you're doing these days?
So I recently started at the Air Force Research Lab. I'm actually in the cubicle across from Matt. Before that, I had spent 9 years at the Defense Intelligence Agency. I'd sort of gotten out of the wargaming business for a while. But it's good to be back in the wargaming business. Dave Ross, who you probably know from the Connections Conference, because he used to go to Connections on occasion, was getting ready to retire, and we were having dinner, and he said, "How would you like to be my relief?" It took a little while for me to realize that that was the right answer, but now I'm in lovely Dayton, Ohio, and enjoying it a great deal, even though we're a little bit overworked these days. But that's never really that big a problem if you're doing something that you enjoy. So things, life is good. Life is good.
The idea of lovely Dayton, Ohio, I think, has just caused half of our audience's heads to explode. So,
well, I'm from Des Moines. So, you know, I'm a Midwest person, even though I spent the last 20 plus years out in, out in the East Coast. So it was funny in our first staff meeting, some of the people were trying to, you know, this is different from Virginia. And I said, look, Ohio, four letters, three syllables, Ohio and Iowa are effectively the same place.
Yeah.
So,
Ohio's a little hillier around the edges.
It sort of feels like coming home.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of cornfields. So. Matt, we're absolutely going to talk to the book, but I do want to, Chris mentioned Connections. I met Dave originally at Origins and then later saw him at Connections, and he actually came down as an observer to one of the gemstone exercises that we did at the National Defense University back, you know, going on 8-9 years ago these days. And that was great having an outside observer there to kind of give us some feedback on the exercises that were going on there. I really appreciated the time he took for that. But you mentioned Connections, and Matt's been sort of the godfather and Monsignor all rolled into one of the Connections Conference over the years. I realize we can go an hour plus just on trying to describe what Connections is and what it does. If we can keep it into 5 minutes-ish, sort of, what is it, what do we do at Connections, and sort of the brief version of how you got started with it? Because I think that's something that people hear us talk about a lot. On podcasts or in discussions around the wargaming world, but they don't really know what it is.
Good. Well, I think in the case of Connections, the origin story does really help to explain what it's doing even now. I was a research associate for Wargaming, so I did the Wargaming part of their curriculum. And this living legend by the name of Colonel John Warden had just taken over Air Command and Staff College. And I had only been in the same room with him twice when he was giving talks and I was in the audience. For all I knew, all indications, there was no reason he would know I exist. Well, it's the eve of Christmas Eve, and people are starting to wrap things up, and I'm wondering how early I can leave without leaving too early, and what do I need to do before I head home. And my phone rings, and it's the Colonel Warden on the other end of the phone. And he starts asking me all these questions about wargaming. And it turns out he was very dissatisfied with the state of wargaming, that when he was coming up with the plan that he called Instant Thunder and got renamed Desert Storm, they tried wargaming it, and it didn't. The wargame didn't produce some of the effects that were later created in the actual conflict. So he was worried that that would reduce the chances of being able to execute the plan because people were getting bad feedback from the war game. And then he was sent down to Air Command and Staff College to train future air component commanders, join air component commanders. And the war games that were available for the school didn't even address some of the approaches to air warfare that needed to be the centerpiece of what he was teaching. So he started asking me all these questions about, well, you know, is anybody doing this right? You know, what do you know about what the Germans are doing, what the hobby areas are doing, or the commercial wargaming guys, or other services? And I said, well, you know, commercial has some real strengths. I think that the military need to look at it more closely, but there's this limitations, and these guys are doing that really well, but there's this limitations. He said, well, is anybody doing everything right? And I said, no, I don't, not that I know of. He said, well, is there anything we can do about that? He says, well, we could get everybody together at some sort of meeting or conference or something where we could learn best practices from each other. He said, okay, go ahead and do it. And then he asked me another question, and I'm trying to listen to the question and think about my answer. And in the back of my mind, it's like, was I just asked to put on a conference? And we talked for 3.5 hours on the phone. And finally he says, well, I got to go. And it's almost regular quitting time. And lights are out. And I'm the last person in the faculty area. And I'm like, what do I do? I can't ask this living legend, was I asked to put on a conference? Because he's a living legend. And at the time, I think I was a major. I was a major at the time. And, you know, he's this colonel. And I said, well, I could ask my boss, but then if I ask my boss, it's like I'm asking to be asked. And I have this bad habit I've been working on. When I don't know what to do, I don't do it. And besides, everybody else had left for Christmas. So I left the building, and then New Year's is over, and we're all back to work. And I still don't know what to do. And I'm over at the main building, walking down the hallway, and Colonel Warden's coming down the hall the other way, and his whole face lights up. And he says, hey, Matt, how's our conference coming? And I was like, oh, very well, sir. I've been giving it a lot of thought. Says, oh, I have a few minutes right now. Do you want to, you know, come back to my office and talk about it? No, sir, that's okay. Let me get on your calendar. So a few months later, we put on the first of the wargaming conferences, the first Connections conference. The very first one wasn't called Connections. It was the Wargaming in Air Power Education Conference or something like that. So, and I think even longer than that, which is why we changed it to Connections the next year. But it has always been dedicated to expanding, advancing, and retaining the art, science, and application of wargaming. And we do that by learning best practices from each other, by demoing war games, having people actually get hands-on playing things. We get it by actually trying to create new knowledge by having working groups that look into different questions. It travels around to different places each year, and part of the benefits of being a sponsor of Connections, you get to pick the theme for that year, and you get a working group that addresses that problem. So this coming year, we're going to be meeting at Quantico Marine Corps Base in Virginia, and they're looking at the applications and limitations, the advantages and disadvantages of AI and wargaming. And so we're going to be putting that together, and we're going to have an outbrief report and all the rest. And it's a great deal for the sponsor because he gets people from all sorts of different backgrounds, so he gets a real broad perspective of that. And for a lot of time, so it started in 93. For the first 17 years or so, there was only a Connections U.S., and then four friends and colleagues in the United Kingdom decided that there could be a second Connections conference, one for Europe. And they put together Connections UK, and it's been getting bigger and better every year. And then the Australians decided it was too hard and too far to come to the U.S., so they started a Connections Oz or Connections Australia. Then the people in the Netherlands started a Connections conference, and I get a chance to be the keynote speaker one year, and really a very well done, really very informative conference. And then Connections North started, the folks up in Canada. With this coming January, there's going to be a Connections France held at the French defense establishment headquarters. And at Connections UK this last September, a gentleman came up to me and said, I'm a Norwegian, and I have a Danish colleague, and we're working on coming up with a Connections Nord for the Scandinavian countries. And would that be okay with you? And I was like, yes. And then there was an article a few months back about somebody saying they were going to start a Connections South in Brazil. And all I know is that one article. So it has very much taken on a life of its own.
And at some point, U.S. Space Command is going to get involved, and you're going to have Connections on the moon.
Yes, that'll be coming up. And it's I think one of the importance, and one of the things particularly I think important to the people that listen to this conference is, I think it's one of the reasons why the Defense Department is taking commercial wargaming more serious these days, because people within the defense industry and people in print computer miniatures could all get together in one place, and academic wargaming. And believe it or not, there are a number of universities in the United States that has courses in creating simulation games, war games, and things like that. And all of them come together at Connections. And when Connections is over, those links remain, and more commercial stuff is finding its way into the military these days.
Oh, darn. Wait, you mean the military guys are actually paying attention to what non-military folks are doing?
It's so intermittent, but it's it happens, I think, more every couple of years.
I'm going to throw this out a little bit for the both of you, but it's something that I had noted a while ago in one of the columns I'd written a while back that's been reprinted over at Armchair Dragoons. But this was probably 2016 when there was a memo out about sort of, stop me if you've heard this before, reinvigorating wargaming in the Department of Defense.
we've heard of that memo, both Chris and I.
Yeah, yeah, that seems to, like, get the signature block changed and photocopied every couple of years. Ultimately, I think there's two real things that are kind of something that the big hurdles that wargaming in the DoD never seemed to really be able to get over. And one of them was the idea of institutionalizing the war games at the schoolhouses such that you expect that every time you're in some sort of professional development curriculum, whether you're an E4 or an O6, that there is going to be a wargaming component to every course you're in some form or fashion relevant to what you do. But in addition to that, the trainers who are going into the instructional roles in those courses have to expect that during the train-the-trainer process, they're going to be taught what wargaming is, how to do it, what makes it tick, why is it useful in the course. And there have been fits and starts towards each of those, far more towards the former than the latter, of getting wargaming into the curriculum such that everybody gets exposed to it, everybody expects it, and everybody knows it's coming when they get to the schoolhouse for whatever schoolhouse it is. You guys have both been around a long time. Matt, what have you seen over the years towards those kind of things? I mean, first of all, am I way off base in my thinking that that's what's needed? And second of all, how close, if at all, have we ever gotten to that?
It's one of the things we need. And I would have agreed with you completely 10 years ago. But one of the, you know, everybody mirror images. And in working on wargaming and doing the digging into the history of wargaming, I don't remember the exact moment the light bulb went off, but I realized that the German War College didn't use war games to teach, but they taught war games, and that the Soviet War College didn't just use war games to teach, they taught their graduates how to wargame as part of the planning cycle after graduation. So when we get, but in the United States military, war games were simply used as one tool in the trainer's toolkit, and very valuable tool. But for example, the Army's Command and General Staff College would have this walk, crawl, run procedure where they would have a one-sided map exercise and then a one-sided field exercise, and then a two-sided map maneuver, which had all the characteristics of a war game, then a two-sided field maneuver, which again had all the characteristics of a war game, but was live, and very effective training, and I think it's one of the reasons we did well in World War II, but nobody taught how to actually conduct war games. So when we get to World War II, and not finding evidence of something is not evidence that doesn't exist, but I've looked and looked and looked to see if I could find any reference to the United States Army doing a war game before any of their World War II operations, and there was like a sentence in one book that said that General Hodges in First Army would do war games before his major operations. He had this lieutenant colonel who had been on the faculty at the Army's Command and General Staff College and knew how to create war games, so he was able to do that. And I'm like, of course, they didn't teach how to do wargaming, but the faculty knew how to do wargaming because they put them on as part of the curriculum. So one of the things that I've been pushing for years is that we not only need to have more wargames in the curriculum, and I think we made a little bit of progress in that area, but in academia, you're only allowed so many hours. So if you add 1 hour of wargaming, you've got to subtract an hour of something else. So there's been, I think, on average, progress, but it's been a tooth and nail, you know, gradual, small progress. And I was very pleased that progress was being made. But then I realized even if we incorporate wargaming everywhere as a training tool, we still will be behind the Russians and we'll still be behind the Germans and we'll still be behind probably the Chinese, or I don't know that for sure, because they are teaching their folks how to conduct war games after graduation. And I've found no evidence of anywhere within the American defense establishment doing that.
But before we take a full turn into discussing the book that you were talking about researching there, I do want to throw this out. And Chris, you've seen some of this a lot over the years as well. And I think you and I actually had a conversation about this once a couple of years ago, that there are a couple of different uses for wargaming. And obviously the one that immediately comes to mind for everybody is the training tool of, hey, let's practice all this on a tabletop where all we're killing is some cardboard instead of actually injuring real guys in a real operation. But as a training tool to learn how to do things, what is right supposed to look like on the map? That's the dominant one that everybody thinks of. For the folks in uniform, the primary place in the U.S. Army, and I think to a lesser extent the Marine Corps, where wargaming becomes relevant is in the military decision-making process, where it's used to compare different courses of action. As you're developing your orders, you want to wargame through these things to see which course of action is going to meet the commander's guidance the best for all the different criteria that you have to evaluate it against. But there's also wargaming as a rehearsal tool. Let's see what this thing looks like. There's yep. wargaming as an experimental concept, and we'll come back around to sort of John Compton's magnum opus recently in War on the Rocks and the dueling professional articles that are out there. We'll let Chris take a swing at that here in a second. One very interesting use of wargaming that I saw in action but wasn't really familiar with until I saw it in action a couple of years ago at the National Defense University was they used the gemstone exercise as a twofold thing. One, to build interest and excitement towards the curriculum that everyone was headed into. So they were playing this game not because they expect anybody to be any good at it or as a rehearsal for something, but to get people interested in the material they were about to go into. But it also served a dual purpose of, for the faculty that were observing the war game, it gave them a benchmark of the level of experience and knowledge and capability of the participants. And so it served as an introduction to the curriculum in that case, which I thought was a pretty neat way to use the game. So when we talk about sort of institutionalizing wargaming in the military, I mean, there's a lot of different directions we can go, whether it's a training tool, a rehearsal tool, an experimentation tool, an interest building tool, a rehearsal. I mean, there's a lot of directions we can go there. Chris, you've seen a bunch of these out there before we start talking about, you know, John and the articles floating around out there. What are some of the successes or failures you may have seen for some of those other ways to use wargaming?
Wargaming is an incredibly diverse tool. As you've said, it can be used to do a lot of different things. During my time at the Naval War College, I did the faculty by day, student by night thing. Wargaming there was used as basically a capstone exercise for one of the courses there. It was used as an analytic tool. I was part of a faculty-moderated, student-executed wargaming group that basically just kept doing the same problem over and over and over and collected data on it. It was used as a way to what's the right way to phrase it? It was used as a way to pull together a bunch of people to sort of get buy-in on various projects.
Yes.
It was used as a context for a discussion. Some of the most interesting projects that I was involved with were ones where they were dealing with like a command and control structure, alternate command and control structures, and they're executing this game while at the same time they've got the wiring diagram up on the wall. So in the context of the game, you're seeing what's working and what isn't, and then the players are going to the wall and making suggestions on like, well, maybe this guy should be reporting to this guy as opposed to this other guy. And so it was trying to get that wiring diagram correct. So there's a lot of different things that can be used. Wargaming is an incredibly powerful tool, and so it's easy to find yourself in a situation where the players are really enraptured by what they're getting out of it, but sometimes you as the designer will go, yeah, we kind of left some money on the table there. We could have done a better job with that. but I've also seen games where it was really kind of for show, right? I've seen things that were called games that really weren't. They were just a bunch of guys sitting around a table talking. Now, I don't have some of the problems that, say, John Compton does in his recent War in the Rocks article with the idea of a bog sat. But I agree with John that sometimes what you end up with are these really elaborate bog sats where they spend a lot of money on them and they try to claim that it's really a war game. But what it really is just getting a bunch of people into a room. War games add structure to a discussion and a decision-making process. And anytime you can add structure to that process, you're going to get more than if you just say, hey, what do you want to talk about? But, you know, if you're going to get a bunch of people together, if you're going to spend a lot of the government's money to do that, I would like to think that you're getting the most that you can get out of it.
I'm reminded of a friend of mine that worked at U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command in a wargaming office up there. When I was in Norfolk one time, we went out to dinner and asked how his day had gone. And he said, yeah, we briefed the CG on the outcome of the war game today. I'm like, oh, you guys wrapped up? You guys just wrapped up today? He goes, no, we wrap up Friday. But they were briefing the outcome of it on Wednesday, but they're wrapping it up on Friday.
I was primarily a guy who I spent a lot of time doing analytical war games. So not so much doing training stuff. I was more along the lines where I was collecting data. and so like you have to create a game that's going to generate the data, and then you have to collect the data because you can't collect data that you haven't generated. You can't analyze data that you haven't collected. Once you get the data, I was quoting Matt on that. That was a great addition to a talk that I give. Matt and I have already had a very productive relationship. I've created some slides that he's put in some of his talks, and I've quoted him in some of mine, and we're both of our products are getting better as a result of us being in cubicles right across the aisle from each other.
Couldn't agree more.
So we're coming up on a half an hour into this, and we've barely mentioned the reason we got Matt on this call in the first place. So Matt, as long as I've known you, literally, you've been working on this book, and it finally escaped into the wild last summer, and so your book on wargaming is a bit of a history of especially professional wargaming, but you cast a much wider net. Most impressively, I think, you've turned over a lot of rocks in a lot of other countries looking for when and where and how wargaming was used over the years. And so I'm curious sort of what inspired you to do this thing, because I don't think it was just a homework assignment on steroids. I think, you know, you have a real love and a passion for this. So what was it that inspired you to do this thing, and how did it evolve over the time that you were digging into it?
Well, my motives kind of evolved, too. It really kind of did start as a homework assignment. I had to do a thesis on my master's in military history, and I'd always been interested in wargaming. As a teenager, I read The Bomb in the Computer, and I said, oh, I'll do it on that. And it got an A, and people said, hey, this is really good. You should write a book. And I'm like, yeah, I should write a book. And that was in 1988. And I'm like, yeah, maybe someday I will, but I didn't really work on it very much. Then I was teaching at Air Command and Staff College, and I did the war game elective. And they said, well, you know, you can have a textbook that goes along with your elective. And I'm like, well, I guess the best book out there is Peter Perl's The Art of War. And I think it's still an outstanding book. There's big sections of that book that I've not been able to equal. But it also, its coverage of Air Force wargaming is captions of two pictures. So I didn't want to use that as the textbook in an Air Force course on wargaming. So I started to do that. But as I worked on the book, I realized there was more important reasons to do it. The most important reason is if you're trying to advance, let's say, aeronautics or some other science, you do experiments and learn new things in chemistry and that stuff like that. But some sciences really don't lend themselves to experimentation. You can't put Jupiter in a test tube. You can't take a hurricane and measure it, you know, inside a laboratory. That some scientists, some sciences, you need data. You need observed data. Well, in the case of wargaming, that observed data is the history. And so as people says wargames can do that or wargames can't do that or wargames have these different capabilities and limitations, well, let's look back at the history of wargaming and see what the Germans did, see what the Russians did, see what the Chinese did, see what we did, and see what worked and didn't work, and then try to use that as the data you go forward on. I remember in the history of astronomy, there were people making very detailed observations of the heavens before this whole sun is in the center of the solar system theory emerged, and that data was necessary for that theory to move forward. So before you can have a real discussion on what works and what doesn't, you really need that foundation of the history. Then the second motivation that I acquired as I was working on the book was that I kept running across these people that made huge contributions to wargaming. And if wargames can save lives, and I have a lot of evidence that they can, then the people who have really moved the ball forward, have really come up with better ways of doing wargaming, are just as deserving of praise as people who come up with new medicines or people who come up with other things that save lives and make them better as inventors, but yet people don't know them. So people like McCarty Little in the U.S. Navy, people like Moody Suter in the U.S. Air Force, you know, Colonel Macedonia in the United States Army, people in the service of these guys, for the most part, haven't even heard their names. So in writing the book, I wanted to make sure that I covered these things. And then finally, one of the things the book covers is just how much simulation wargaming that actually tries to replicate the way war works, how much it has spread. It started in one royal family in one nation in Europe, and now it's being used on almost every country. The one reason the book took so long is it kept getting delayed. I turned it into the Naval War College Press on the 3rd of April, 2017. 2016. It took 3 years for it to get published, almost just a little bit shy of 3 years. And they these different delays, and they really tried hard, and they're good people, and I will be ever grateful to them. But something else would go wrong, and it'd be a delay. And during one of those delays, I said, you know, I really need to add a bit to my last chapter, trying to get a feel for the scope of wargaming today. If I write something up and get it to you while we're delayed for this reason, can you add it into that chapter? And they're like, yeah, sure. You know, we owe you at least that much. So I went home and I fired up my computer and I got up the Google machine and I entered in, you know, tell me the 25 biggest militaries on Earth. And I was surprised that there was about 6 or 8 different websites that all said they figured out the 25 biggest. So I spent about a half an hour looking at the different websites to see which one I believed, then took down their 25 nations and then just typed in to Google the name of the nation and the word wargaming. And I got multiple hits on wargaming by each of those nations, 24 of the 25. So whoever our adversary will be in the future, whoever our allies will be, whoever our coalition partners are, the odds are very high that they wargame. And if wargaming does give us an edge in war, and I think the history I've written illustrates that, then it's probably a good idea for us to wargame more effectively than our adversaries. And so this book is hopefully provides the data, provides the background information that will help us wargame more effectively than those that we're opposed to.
We've got a variety of the history of wargaming. Like you said, you know, look, I'll admit it, whole lot of people in this book I'd never heard of, going right back to what you had talked about, which was, you know, these are folks that people probably should know but don't. It was a little distressing that, you know, again, the people in the wargaming world hadn't heard of a lot of these folks. And so that was a little concerning. But again, given the almost second class treatment it has in a lot of cases, it's, you know, when you really think about it, not that big of a surprise. I was really fascinated by a variety of the historical wargaming stories you were able to dig up beyond the usual suspects, right? We know von Reiswitz and Kriegsspiel coming out of Germany. We know H.G. Wells and Little Wars. We know the infamous Japanese war games in advance of Pearl Harbor and Midway and Wake Island and all the others in World War II. And then sort of the Fletcher Pratt stuff we had here in the U.S. But you were able to uncover some pretty interesting anecdotes from some of the other countries that aren't those usual suspects, or from some of the countries where they were, but stories that we didn't necessarily know. Is there one or two of those that were particularly memorable to you as either a really good story, or, hey, how come nobody knew about this, or, wow, that's kind of neat?
Well, let me tell you one that managed to get in the book, and one that didn't, and why there needs to be a second edition or a second book. The one that it was another one of the delays, and I found out that a colonel that I had worked for when we were both in war games together had retired and was now a GS umpty-up as a deputy director of like J9 or something like that. So I called him up and he remembered me and we had a nice conversation. And I said, you know, there's been a delay and I have a little bit more time and I want to make sure I'm not missing anything. And from where you are, you should be able to tell me. And he said, well, does your book have this? Oh, yeah, it has that. Well, does your book have this? Oh, yeah, I have that. Well, does your book have the time that the Soviet general staff and the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff conducted a joint war game against each other? I'm like, no, that's a thing that happened. And so they actually were able to help put me in touch with the people that did it. And very late in the history of the Soviet Union, we were trying to better understand each other's analysis methods so we wouldn't draw false conclusions or the whole business about, you know, stumbling into war because we don't understand each other. And one of the things that they came to the conclusion would be useful is if we actually participated in a war game together where the Soviets played the Soviets and we played the Americans and we walked through how the war game was conducted. And the war game was a Pall Mill war game, political military, looking at the breakup of the Soviet Union. And they conducted that war game months before the breakup of the Soviet Union. The war game, through adjudication, not through planning, basically resulted in the breakup of the Soviet Union. And if you think about the breakup of empires, they're almost always violent, that the people make miscalculations, they panic. But here, the people that were going to be in charge when it actually happened saw it unfold so that it wasn't as much as a surprise when it actually occurred. So the folks, you know, by this point I had been working on the book for over 20 years. I had never heard that it happened, and I certainly never heard of the names of the people that made it happen, but that got into the book. The thing that I most regret not getting into the book is I had very little on interwar French wargaming. And it turns out there's much more than I knew. The French actually did a war game of a German thrust through the Ardennes. And in the war game, the Germans were played by French. And the Germans basically followed French doctrine. So they had this armored thrust through the Ardennes. They got to the Meuse River. And then they sat there for 4 days while their heavy artillery moved up. And once their heavy artillery got there, they were able to force a crossing over the Meuse. The French had been moving in reserves to contain the bridgehead. But when the war game was over, the French decided this was a rather dangerous development, so they needed to strengthen that sector. So they changed out the Category 3 Reserve Division for a Category 1, the highest category, Reserve Division. They allocated like 300,000 francs, which I guess bought them about 6 pillboxes. And they thought, well, it was fairly serious, so we've taken some fairly significant steps. Of course, when the actual Germans executed the same operation that was anticipated in the war game. They didn't follow French doctrine. They followed German doctrine. And basically on that day of the war, the Luftwaffe focused on providing the support to get the German army across the Meuse, even though their artillery was still well to the rear. And because they got across the Meuse that quickly, the French hadn't really even started to move up reserves. And that leads to Dunkirk, and that leads to the destruction of the French armies so abruptly. And again, I've read I don't know how many books about World War II. I don't know how many war games I've played on World War II. And I find that out after my book has gone to print.
Well, you know, there was always going to be something, right? In your case.
Oh, yeah, of course. There always is.
It happened to be quite a bombshell there. Chris, you've observed Matt's development of this book over many years. Just real quickly, did it come out even close to when you thought he might finally be finished with it?
Yes, because it eventually, I mean, either yes or no, it depends on how you interpret it. I was beginning to wonder if it was ever going to come out. Not that I, because it just seemed to be one of, you know, sometimes you have those projects that never seem to end. And so I know that Matt was working on it the entire time. Every time I saw him, we'd talk about what the current state of the book was. But, you know, Wargaming, during the majority of the time when Matt was working on this book, it's not like Wargaming was the hot topic that all the publishers were just craving to publish a Wargaming book. So I sort of wondered. You know, I knew that I was going to buy a copy. I knew that everybody on this phone call was going to buy a copy. But it's not like, you know, I didn't expect it to show up on the New York Times bestseller list. So
I do want to
pleasantly surprised that it did eventually come out.
I do want to caveat. I did not, in fact, need to buy my copy. I got a review copy. So and we did review it. It did appear. We did review it. We did all of our due diligence. And I've actually loaned the book out twice to people who were interested. I've managed to get it back both times, which I wasn't 100% sure I would. But I did manage to get it back both times.
And it's probably worth pointing out that you can download the PDF from the Naval War College website. The right answer is probably to do a search for on Wargaming free Naval War College in Google, because the Naval War College at some point redid their website and made it hard to navigate.
Well, so, Chris, the right answer, at least in the short term, is we're going to link it to the posting of this podcast on our site. So,
excellent.
You just got to follow the link, and we'll get you there that way.
Yeah, but don't do that if you're driving your car and listening to this podcast.
I would recommend, please, no.
I'm trying to help you not get named in the lawsuit.
Yes, well, that I do appreciate that. And I dare say the electronic copy certainly allowed for something that, let's face it, we all know at least two dozen of the people I'm about to describe, and not a one of them will admit to it in public. They opened the PDF, Control F, typed in their own name. We know those people. Those people exist. They won't admit to being those people, but we know they're out there. The first thing they did was look to see.
I think I probably will admit to being one of those people.
that they wanted to see where Matt mentioned them in their book, if at all. And I think for some of them, there was probably chagrin if they were not. And there's probably a few of them relief that they were not. So.
Yeah, I did have somebody get the copy of the book. And while he was standing there, looked up and said, I'm in the index 5 places. It's a good book. But yeah, I was shocked at how successful it is. This is the 22nd of October while we're recording this. It's been downloaded 5,708 times from the Naval War College website. Back in like April, I added up all the others, and I'm sure they've been downloaded some since. all the others had been downloaded about a little over 2,000 times. There's 44 books in the series. So one book is 5,700. The other 43 are a little over 2,000. So just insanely popular. The Navy bought a bunch of books so that when military organizations requested one, they could send it to them. They ran out of their copies in 6 weeks. By the time this is posted, they should have more back in stock. They're getting the government printing office to run more. The government printing office ran out of the copies they printed in 15 days. And they've gone out and they've now had a kind of print-on-demand situation that they set up with a basket of books to do an initial test of it. And On Wargaming was picked as one of the books in that basket. So so much more. You know, you work on something for over two decades. You kind of hope it would be successful. But this has been way more successful than I ever hoped.
You may not be able to parse this information from the available data, but is there any indication of what the split is, U.S. versus non-U.S., on downloads, on purchases, on... Well, because, like, we've mentioned the Connections Conference is... You know, it's spreading like a plague. I mean, this is, you know, we could, the next edition of Pandemic is going to be Pandemic Connections Conferences where they're taking over the globe. So, I mean, there's clearly an interest in this around the world. Not that the Russians are trying to download it to steal all our wargaming secrets, but, you know, are the Scandinavians grabbing it? Are the Aussies grabbing it? Are the Brazilians downloading copies of this? Because there's a real interest in this and a dearth of other options floating around out there. Is that data available? And if so, what's it telling you?
That's very interesting. I don't know if the Navy War College has a way of tracking who downloads it. But when I got over to the Connections Conference in London last September, all these people walked up to me and said, I've downloaded your book. My wife was yelling at me. I went through it in 3 days. What a great book. And thank you. And just on and on about it. So apparently they're downloading it in the United Kingdom. I don't really know other than that one time and that one nation.
Yeah, well, they don't need to translate it either.
Yeah, they don't need to translate it, so that helps. Oh, but a formal request has been made by the Japanese government to translate the book for their use, and I've said okay.
Wow, that's kind of awesome. Our primary audience are not the usual military wargaming suspects. Our primary audience are hobby gamers. If I'm a hobby gamer and somebody says, hey, you should really check out this book on wargaming that Matt's done, as a hobby wargamer, what are some of the key things that I'm probably looking to get out of this book? What should I really, what's my incentive as the hobby gamer to pick this thing up and to go through it?
Well, I think you have several motivations. One is I've had people come up to me and say, you know, I work in wargaming and I thought I really needed to read your book and I enjoyed it. I'm like, well, I want people to read it to enjoy it. Well, I knew you'd want them to, but I really enjoyed it. So this is kind of an interesting story. Most hobby wargamers are also hobby historians. A lot of hobby wargamers are professional historians. And some of the things that I was unable to uncover kind of tells the rest of the story. Was it Paul Harvey would tell these stories, and then at the end there'd be one bit of information that would put everything into perspective? You know, I think you better understand the Battle of Midway. I think you better understand Blitzkrieg. I think you better understand the Pacific Theater of World War II after reading this book. And then another reason I think the hobbyist would find it useful to read is that a lot of people who do wargaming are like, why are you doing wargaming? Are you a war mongler? Do you like war? You know, war is so terrible. Why are you doing it as a game? And I'm sure all of us have run into some people like that. Well, this book shows wargames save lives. That the side that wargames more effectively suffers fewer casualties. A really effective pall mill wargame might be able to avoid a war altogether. So we shouldn't be embarrassed as hobby wargamers. Hobby wargame is like hobby doctor. We're doing something that has real value to our society. And then finally, when I wrote the book, I didn't write it only for a military audience. There's a section of the book that says, if you're a parent and you want your kids to be successful in life, here's how war games can help you help your kids be more successful. If you own your own business, here's how adapting wargaming techniques in an economic sense can help you be more effective in your business. If you're in government and you've never worn a uniform, but you're part of the defense establishment, here's how wargaming can help you better understand how this military stuff works. So if you're a voter and you want to better understand what your politicians are telling you that is correct and what is incorrect, wargaming can help you with that. So a lot of utility to folks that have never worn the uniform.
There are places in the book where you do talk about the bleed over between hobby wargaming and professional wargaming, and you've mentioned a couple of those already. Was there a particular story in there where hobby wargaming bleeding into the military sort of really jumped out as, hey, that's kind of a neat tale, or, you know, this is something unexpected that I hadn't heard? Because we've heard about sort of the Gulf Strike Arabian Nightmare scenario when Gulf One was happening. You know, oh my God, we got to hurry up and buy every copy of this game we can find in D.C. and get it into the Pentagon. But there have been others over the years. Is there one that's jumped out at you that was particularly memorable in pulling the book together?
Well, unfortunately, that one was the most memorable. Yeah. And I don't know if I don't recall if I mentioned this specific thing in the book, but I've been trying to get the military to take hobby wargaming serious for a long time. I don't like calling it hobby wargaming. I call it popular wargaming or commercial wargaming or civilian wargaming. But one of the things that I talk when I talk to the military folks is that a commercial wargame is created to make money from commercial sales. They're not optimized to meet military needs, but every now and then you find something that's exactly what you need. So the analogy I use is that the Command and General Staff College, a lot of our textbooks came from military authors, but some of them were commercial histories that we just bought off the shelf and used. So we've run into maybe 3 cases, maybe 5 cases over the years where exactly the commercial game was exactly what the person needed. And the thing that jumps out in my own mind, and I frankly don't remember, it's in the book, is the this game called Dark Waters. It's a commercial war game. It was used at Annapolis, and maybe still is. And the faculty member that used it was at Connections one year. And I asked him, if the CNO gave you $1 million, you know, how would you modify this game to make it more effective? And he looked me right in the eye and said, I wouldn't change the box art. That it's like he was channeling what I was trying to teach my students. It's exactly what I want. But then one thing that is in the book that I think would surprise a lot of hobby wargamers is maybe there's 3, maybe there's 5 cases where a wargame is used as is. There's probably 20 cases, 30 cases where the military will take a commercial wargame and modify it and use the modified version, or the commercial guys will make the modification and then sell it to the military. And probably the most prominent example of that in recent history is the out of the United Kingdom. The publisher called Slytherin has a commercial game called Command Air and Naval that looks at contemporary and really any post-World War II air and naval operation anywhere in the globe. I think they bought the Jane's database. Well, the publisher made some modifications to make the design more attractive to the military, and a lot of different militaries, including our own and including the Brits and a number of other countries, are using this, and it's not cheap. They finally figured out you make fewer sales to the military, but you get to charge more. But it's a lot cheaper than trying to create it from scratch, and adjudication engine software that supports wargame within the military tend to be user obnoxious, and something that comes out of the commercial field, you know, you'd go out of business as a publisher if your wargame was too hard to learn and too hard to execute. So as a rule, Commercial stuff's much better in that way than anything produced in the military.
You know, the guys from Slytherin, one of the other games that was in that package that the UK Ministry of Defense was interested in was the Flashpoint Campaigns game by the guys from On Target Sims that Slytherin is the publisher, OTS are the developers. We just had OTS on a recent podcast talking about the Flashpoint Campaign series, and we did specifically ask about some of the distal work. So folks that are interested in where that hobby game bleed over into the professional ranks is happening, it's probably about two podcasts ago by the time this one goes live. But you can go look up the podcast where we had Jim and Jeff and Rob on there from On Target Sims talking about the work they're doing with the distal guys over in the UK in the MOD. The other one, Matt, you may not be aware of this. Chris might, only because I think he may be a little more dialed into the fiction world. There's a book out there called Northern Fury. It's either Northern Fury H-Hour or H-Hour Northern Fury. I don't remember what order it goes in. The guy, there are two authors of it, and Joel and Bart are the two authors. Joel is an active duty Army officer. Bart is a scenario designer and wargamer that met doing wargaming and doing some AARs of scenarios for Command Modern Air Naval Ops. And the AARs that Joel was developing around Bart's scenarios grew into a much larger narrative that has now become the first of a planned series of novels that have been published about Cold War goes hot in the mid-90s. There's a different backstory that involves the Soviet Union not breaking up, but it involves the Cold War going hot in the mid-90s, and it's all built around a bunch of scenarios that Joel had played as a part of his command campaigns. So it's not just the professional military world that's being influenced by Command, it's also the literary world that is now being influenced by Command.
And similar things have happened before. Red Storm Rising, Hunt for Red October, big chunks of both of those books were war games that Larry Bond and Tom Clancy played against each other. And some of the dialogue in Red Storm Rising were word-for-word conversations that Larry and Tom had as they were playing the war games. So you talk about bleed over. There's bleed over in several directions.
Yep. I think a lot of folks may already have known about the Red Storm Rising one just because the Dance of the Vampire story has been around for going on almost 30 years at this point. The Northern Fury H-Hour one is pretty recent. A lot of folks, I don't think, may have been aware of where that one came from. But when you were talking specifically about Command Modern Air Naval Ops, that's what made me think of it. We've got a few minutes to wrap up here. I want to circle back around to something we had alluded to earlier in the call, and that is some of the discussions going on in the professional wargaming world right now, where there have been a couple of different articles published in, it's not really the popular military press, but sort of the non-academic yet still thinking man's military press. It's the best way I can think of characterizing something like A War on the Rocks or a couple of these other more high-minded, though not academically focused, military sites out there. And these were talking about wargaming, and several of them authored by people that we know. John Compton, who works in analytical wargaming, had published an article recently about sort of some of the headaches around analytical wargaming. Peter Perla and some other folks published more of a direct rebuttal to John's article. Chris, you were talking before we started recording about another article that just recently dropped that was actually written before John's was even published. But we've seen over the years a couple of these dueling articles appear. Chris, can you give us the pricey version of the three most recent ones and sort of what's the kerfuffle that's currently going on around them?
Well, I can tell you about John's article. The others, I've got the tabs open in my browser. I haven't actually had a chance to read them yet because they just came out like 2 days ago and I've been traveling. John's article, John works at OSD Cape, Cost Analysis and Program Evaluation, and he basically says that as far as analytic war games go, that Cape is so unsatisfied with what they're getting, what they're being offered from the service centers, or from the services, from the FFRDCs, federally funded research and development corporations, like or centers, actually, research and development centers like RAND and CNA and places like that, and by defense contractors, that they basically have stopped using them. That they will, that they do their stuff in-house now, because what they get when they request outsiders to do games for them is they get a bunch of guys sitting around the table talking, and they get, as John puts it, great insights like cyber is going to be important, and they're spending an awful lot of money to get those wonderful insights like that. John, I think, is John's trying to be provocative. He's trying to start the discussion, and it's working from that point of view. And I've seen some of this stuff that they've done there, and you know, they take their analysis very seriously. They're pretty rigorous in how they approach it. They do some really pretty good work. And John's a PhD social scientist. He's a methodologist. You know, John's one of those people that when he says something, I stop and listen to it. Even if my initial inclination is to go, nah, I think he's wrong with that, I still stop and think about it very carefully, because John's thought about it very carefully. He doesn't make off-the-cuff comments. The other people that are participating in this debate, Phil Parnell wrote a response. Well, he's the one who had the article that was already in the pipeline. And Peter Perla and Ed McGrady and some other folks that work at CNA did the other one. They're all very thoughtful people, too. You know, I used to work for Peter and with Ed. This is very much a group of people that have known each other for a long time and have been having discussions like this for a long time, that are now doing it in public so that we can all participate, which is a good thing, because there's other people out there that should see this debate, right? We shouldn't be hiding our lantern under a bushel basket. We should be having this conversation in public where other people can benefit from it. So that's pretty much what's going on right now.
The analytical wargaming world in which John lives is a very different world than I think a lot of our hobby audience is going to think of wargaming. And we mentioned it earlier in this call, the idea of wargames as a training tool. That's totally not where John's coming from. John's
right. No, it's not.
Yeah,
it's not.
So his analytical tools, very different kind of wargaming where you're looking at sort of trying to project things out towards the future. What can we do? What should we do? What should we not do? Kind of implied in all of that. Matt, I know you had set up a variety of these over the years, because we'd actually tried one time to figure out a way to get me involved in one of those up in Dayton. Mm-hmm. What for the hobby audience that has no concept of what an analytical war game is there a short version of what one of these things is, and what are the kinds of things that you're trying to learn through an analytical war game?
Okay, I'm really glad you asked me that question, because I've got to do one of these articles before too much time goes by. I think there's a larger category that I call a decision support war game. And a decision support war game is one where you're trying to provide insights to the decision maker to increase the odds that he's right more often than the enemy commander is right. And within that category of decision support war game, you have two extremes. And one extreme is certainly the analytical war game, where the decision cycle is such that you have time to incorporate a lot of techniques that were originally developed within the Operations Research Society or developed within the probability and statistics community and elsewhere into your wargaming efforts to increase your likelihood of coming up with insights that would actually be of value. On the other extreme is what I'm calling right now COA war games, because that's the most common part, where you're trying to support a decision maker, but that decision needs to be made by 1600 hours today. And you can only incorporate whatever analysis you have that you've still done by 1600 today. One of the very earliest connections conferences, there was an SES2 from J9, J7, somewhere in the joint staff, and he was talking about all this rigor, and Colonel Warden leaned over and whispered in my ear, when are these guys going to understand that perfect analysis provided 15 minutes after the air operations order is sent to the field is worthless? And so for that extreme of the spectrum, more analysis isn't better. More analysis doesn't fit within the decision cycle that you have at that end of the spectrum. Well, a lot of commercial war games, because you want it to be entertaining and you want to be able to play it in an evening or just a few hours, are much closer to your course of action war game within the military. That you can have some analysis. The old strategy and tactics magazines would sometimes talk about ways you could do analysis, even in hobby-type wargaming, but they're also designed to be relatively quick. Your analysis wargame, you better have a bigger decision cycle, and you can incorporate all these other techniques to increase the utility of what you're coming up with. One of the things I object to is people that say, well, the only good war games are analytical war games, and war game has to have, you know, so much analytical rigor, and you know, this is an exaggeration, and you should never take less than 14 months to do the war game. To which my response is, the decision is being made at 1600 today. You're either going to get insights from a war game that's done by 1600, or you're not going to get any insights at all.
We discussed this in the podcast with the guys from OTS, but I think you guys have probably seen this also. One of the reasons for the sort of feature bloat in some of those the DoD big project war games, those 14-month decision cycles like you were talking about there, that need an army of retired majors to make go. There's this idea that we have to model everything we can possibly model, and we have to model it all perfectly, in part because if something isn't the least bit perfect, then it provides the excuse for what went wrong, right? Well, if your model had incorporated this thing over here, then our whole plan would have worked perfectly, and the world would have been success and rainbows and unicorns and puppies and blah, blah, blah. But because your model was messed up for failing to account for something, therefore our brilliant genius plan failed. And right. and we see that down at the training level. Like it's one of the reasons. Look, when I was an intel guy, one of the things that used to always come up in war games that I used to always ask about was, why don't we ever see any false positives in a war game? Right, when you're doing counterinsurgency stuff, some mob suddenly appears out on a street corner somewhere, and everybody freaks out. Oh my God, what is it? A food riot? Is it a religious call to arms? What's going on? Maybe, you know, soccer team just won a big rivalry game and they're out celebrating. But like that sort of false positive never shows up, because if it does and you react incorrectly to it, suddenly everybody goes, oh, well, if it wasn't for the soccer hooligans, we'd have had the perfect plan and we wouldn't have pissed off all the locals and blah, blah, blah. Well, that kind of stuff really happens in the real world. Why don't we incorporate these sorts of things? And so this idea that if the model isn't perfect and fully voluminous and accounts for every possible permutation, then the participants have a built-in immunization to negative results. Is that something you've seen? What has been your experience with something like that?
Oh, this is a very good, that's an excellent, excellent question. And you bring up one of the things that's really difficult within military wargaming and all wargaming, and one of the things you can very easily, one of the traps you can very easily fall into. When I do a war game within the military, and one of the other reasons to buy on wargaming is that some of the book deals with how to design more effective war games, I try to come up with a complexity budget that if I know my decision cycle, if I know when the sponsor needs the outcome of the war game, then I know how much complexity is that I can get into overall. And then I kind of ration that complexity going into the greatest amount of detail in the areas that have the biggest impact. I'm very grateful to RAND. They came up with a methodology to try to identify if you're only going to spend so much detail, where does it need to be spent? It's basically a matrix where you look at what are the things that can cause you the most harm, and then what are the probability of those things happening. And something that has a high probability and a high impact are the things that you need to be model most carefully within your war game. And you make those decisions before you start doing the detailed depiction. So in the context of a commercial war game, war games that take 12 hours to play don't get played. You know, you may play it in a two, three-hour evening or 4 hours on a Saturday afternoon, and if you don't get to the end of the war game, maybe you're not going to play it again. So you know how much – so you kind of have the decision cycle. You need a war game that has a cycle that covers that amount of time, and then you do your historical research or you look at the situation and say, okay, if I need to get to the end in this amount of time, I can only have so many rules – what rules, what data, what aspects do I need to model in my war game that are the most vital to making sure that I accurately depict the situation that I'm looking at? And so it's not that a lot of rigor is good or a lot of rigor is bad. It's that we need to act within the decision cycle of the decision makers. You need to create war games within the time the players have to execute them. So you need to make a conscious effort of deciding what rigor to invest in and what things you can round off or just even ignore because they're not really consequential to the outcome. And maybe you're going to guess wrong. But if, like you say, if you throw everything in, you have a 16-month professional war game or a 200-hour commercial war game, and neither one's a success.
Yeah, I think at some point you just hit the wall of participant fatigue, don't you?
Right.
Yeah.
So know where that wall is, and then prioritize what do you need to cover most.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing how many places in life that applies beyond just wargaming, yeah. Right? If we're talking household renovations, where are you going to get the most bang for your buck? You know,
yes.
If we're going on vacation, where do I get the most bang for my buck? So yeah, it's amazing how many places that actually applies. Listen, we're a little over the normal time we take. Again, look, it's a podcast. People can always hit pause and come back to it. But we are a little beyond the time we normally ask folks to give us both as guests and as listeners. And so we definitely appreciate the time from the both of you tonight. You know, Matt, especially your efforts on the book, because it's a great book. And, you know, again, look, it's available for free as a PDF, folks. But, you know, if you get a chance to pick up the hard copy, it looks darn cool sitting up on your shelf. And so, Matt, thank you for the book. Really. I mean, it's a great work, and I appreciate you doing that on the behalf of wargamers everywhere. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Chris, one of these days you got to show up at a convention with us again, dude, just so we can go have a beer. Like, you know, come back to us.
I was at a convention this past weekend. Where were you?
I'm at a wargaming convention.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to remember the last wargaming convention I went to. PressCon in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
I was at PressCon in back in February.
Yeah, because you still lived there at the time.
So I did. And I'm actually planning on going. I'm hoping to be able to go back this coming February.
Well, look, you're in commute. Dayton is still commuting distance to Columbus that you should come join us at Origins next summer, even if only for a day trip.
If it wasn't for the fact that I was in the middle of the move, I had the move from hell. And if that move had happened, like either a month later or a month earlier, I would have been at Origins this year. So I'm hoping to make it next year. That's the plan anyway.
Well, we are definitely going to try and rope you into a guest speaker slot or two on behalf of the Armchair Dragoons. See if we can't help get the speaker count at the War College over there with Matt up a little higher. And see if we can't get the Armchair Dragoons banners flying just a little bit higher while we're there.
Sounds like a good plan to me.
Cool.
Worthy goal.
Guys, thank you again. Audience, thank you for sticking with us, going, you know, 25% longer than normal on our podcast here. Again, we've got the links will be in the article posting with this podcast. So the links to the articles we discussed through War on the Rocks, the links to Matt's book, the links to some of the other books that we've tossed out there over the years and discussed, you'll be able to find all of those there. And we'll even just, you know, throw Matt a bone. We'll throw the link for Connections in there as well. And
thank you.
And let folks come play with that. So on behalf of the Armchair Dragoons, this has been Mentioned in Dispatches. We appreciate everybody joining us, and good night.